From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudette. I want to start today's show with a couple of numbers. As of last week, more than 1 million people in the United States have died from COVID-19. 500 people every day are dying from the virus. You heard that right. 500 people every day here in the United States are still losing their lives to COVID. Now, despite those numbers, many say the pandemic is over. And in fact, last Thursday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention changed many of its recommendations around COVID-19. The Wall Street Journal reports that according to the CDC, schools and workplaces no longer have to screen healthy people and students. The 6-foot distancing rule has been dropped, and unvaccinated people do not have to quarantine after exposure to COVID. Now, all of this is coming as kids are heading back to school in Idaho. In fact, the Boise School District started school today. So here's the question. Is the COVID pandemic really over? Has the virus or the science behind it changed? Here to break that down for us is Dr. David Pate. He is a former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of Idaho's Coronavirus Task Force. Dr. Pate, thanks so much for being here today.
Sure thing, Gemma.
Now, remember, folks, if you have a question about COVID or monkeypox, or frankly, even polio, email us, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Dr. Pate, to say that you have been busy on Twitter lately, I think is an understatement.
Well, there's lots to talk about.
There is. So the first thing I want to talk about is the school year. As I mentioned, the Boise School District went back to school today. And I want to talk about a tweet that you sent out just a few hours ago. So you said, quote, bracing myself for what we are going to see with infections and hospitalizations in kids when schools open and operating plans in 2022 are worse than at any prior point in the pandemic. So Dr. Pate, how worried are you about this?
Well, certainly not panicked, but I'm concerned. And, the reason I'm concerned is because we continue to have this kind of narrow line of thinking that, frankly, is exemplified by what you refer to in the opening of this show with the CDC guidelines that, okay, we don't have to worry about the 6 foot of distance anymore. You don't have to quarantine if you're infected. We don't need to do any screenings, et cetera. And I certainly get where everybody's coming from because pretty much there are fewer and fewer people that really want to pay any attention to this. But I think you also hit the point that even though we certainly are in a better position in terms of the protection of the population, as you mentioned, we've got more than 500 people a day dying of this disease still. And that's too bad and regrettable, I think. But the other thing that is, even if we were to say, look, there's a certain acceptable amount of death that we're willing to tolerate. Mm-hmm. And we've done this before. We do this with many other things that, okay, we're just willing to accept that there's going to be a certain number of deaths. What is most disappointing about the CDC and what others fail to grasp is that this, again, is not just a binary outcome. You either live or you die. The problem is it totally disregards the welfare of immunocompromised individuals. It totally disregards the risk of long COVID. It totally disregards the fact that there's a lot of disturbing things that we see that are the consequence of infection that we don't know what the long-term effects are, because even though it seems like we've been dealing with this for, decades, it's been a little over 2 years and we just don't know. And so there's just not a lot of regard for people's health. Understandable regard that, yeah, we want deaths down, we want hospitalizations down, but there's just so much more.
And Dr. Pate, I want to talk about something when we talk about deaths and that inherent risk, right, that you're willing to take. And I know There are people who, during this entire thing, have said, well, it's no more than the flu. According to CDC data, about 12,000 to 52,000 people die annually from the flu in the United States. That is a significant number. Let's compare that to, though, what we're seeing right now with COVID. If 500 people in the U.S. die daily from COVID, annually, that would be 182,500 people. That's exponentially different than 12,000, even up to 52,000 deaths annually from the flu.
Well, that's right, Jim. And, you know, that 500 deaths a day right now, you know, we're also talking about a time when we don't have as many deaths as we have had with some other waves. And plus the fact that, again, this totally disregards, but what about long COVID? You know, the estimates are that we've got 18 to 24 million Americans with long COVID. And of those, probably somewhere in the vicinity of 40% of them, at least, are at the point where they can't work, or they have to reduce their hours of work, or they can't work in the same line of work that they were before, all at a time when, I don't really have to tell any of your listeners, we're challenged with lots of businesses not having the workforces that they need. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to add this on top of things. And this is going to be an impact to healthcare costs, and even if you're not worried about healthcare costs, realize that that gets passed along to you if you purchase insurance, whether you get it through your employer or not. And it's going to affect employee productivity, which makes businesses less profitable. And so guess what businesses do when they're less profitable? Usually the prices go up. So it does have a lot of long-range potential problems that we're just not even discussing.
So let's talk about these new CDC guidelines that came out last Thursday. Has the science changed? I mean, does this mean that that COVID is over, that we've moved beyond it? I mean, what does all of this mean?
Well, you know, unfortunately, the science has not significantly changed with respect to some of the changes in the advice. Now, the issue about the 6 foot of distance, yes, the science has changed on that. Well, really, the science hasn't changed, but the CDC has finally accepted the science that this virus is airborne. This virus can be transmitted in aerosols. And so, as frankly, Gemma, you and I have talked about for, you know, at least a year, probably a year and a half, is that this can be transmitted in air streams much further than 6 feet. But so, yes, 6 feet is no longer a safe zone. But when the CDC couched their guidelines, it made it seem like, well, you don't have to worry about distance at all. And so it just wasn't communicated very well. But, you know, we can step back for a second, Jim, and we don't even have to get into a lot of technical science. Let's just say that you have a virus, you put in a lot of public health measures, and yet you're still having a lot of transmission. Now, more transmissible variants come along. Does it make sense to lessen your public health measures and protections if it's more transmissible and the measures you were using couldn't even stop the less transmissible? So all we have to do is use common sense to see, you know, this doesn't add up. What we're doing is we're continuing this to promulgate this notion of, you know, it's colloquially referred to as just living with the virus. Yes, we're going to have to live with this virus, but so many people think that that means, okay, well, then we just throw all caution to the wind. That's not what it means.
So then how will these new CDC guidelines impact transmission of the coronavirus, and especially with school being back in session for most of the state of Idaho?
Well, that's my concern, and that's what prompted my tweet. Look, school boards, understandably, look to the CDC guidance. I've not seen any cases where they're going to do more, and they often do less. So if the CDC relaxes their guidance without really good basis other than just kind of, you know, admitting defeat, then schools are not going to take the precautions they need to take. Now, before anybody gets, you know, their hair on fire that I'm suggesting that we have to have, you know, mask mandates, and no, and it's never been that way. The problem has been so many schools have just looked at it is, are we going to require masks or not? And, you know, the problem is that's not the right question. The right question is, what are we going to do at times when we're having surges in transmission? And then what are we going to do at times when we're not? Those can be two different things. The second thing is that it doesn't have to be a question of just masks or not masks. Yes, if you require masks, you're going to have a safer school year, especially as in a few months, we'll start dealing with influenza as well. But I am a realist. I understand that there's a lot of school boards that just don't think that's politically tolerable or acceptable. Okay, well, then the next question should be, if not masks, what else are we going to do? Because there's many ways to help try to prevent the spread of this disease in schools, but I just don't see schools looking at those alternatives if they're not going to do masks. And there's a lot of alternatives, and I think we've wasted time, and frankly, I think we wasted a lot of those early pandemic funds that could have helped schools improve their ventilation, filtration, air handling systems, so that frankly, not only would this be safer in schools for COVID, but frankly, for, you know, other things that we're invariably going to face, influenza and other transmissible viruses.
So what would make a good school plan?
Well, I think that there's several things. First of all, as I said, and I just don't see it in the plans that I'm seeing, you know, and we looked at Boise's school district's plan. First of all, there ought to be some planning for, as I said last, in just a few minutes ago, what do we do if we're seeing a surge in cases, or that may be translated into we've got a significant number of teachers out ill, or we have a significant number of the students out ill. What are you going to do? That should prompt a change in your precautions when you know that you're having a lot of transmission, a lot of people out sick. And then the other question, what do we do when things are doing better, when we're not in a surge and we aren't having many people sick? So it shouldn't be a static plan. It should be a plan that adjusts for the level of transmission. And second of all, it should reflect all that we've learned and the science about how this virus transmits. I am still seeing, as I pointed out in the Boise plan, a lot of emphasis on cleaning surfaces for COVID. That's not how COVID's transmitted. And the fact that we're in 22 in the third school year since the first outbreak of this, and people still think the way you control COVID is by cleaning surfaces, that's a problem. And look, I am all for transmitting surfaces. There's plenty of other things that are transmitted that way. But that shouldn't be your COVID plan. And so we have to take steps that actually address how this virus is transmitted. And so that means that you've got to have protections for droplet transmission and aerosol transmission. So what are you doing? And if you decide you're not going to use the primary protection for that, which is masks, which I understand why they might decide that, well, then, okay, what are we doing about air handling? How many air exchanges per hour are we going to do? What are we doing for air filtration? Are we recirculating air or exhausting air? Are we, you know, what are we going to do? CO2 monitoring? How are we going to know how our air handling is? Are we going to do any filtering? Are we going to use HEPA filters? Are we going to use Corsi Rosenthal boxes? You know, what are you going to do? And I just see nothing. There's just, I don't see anything in these plans.
So Dr. Pate, got a question and quite a few questions coming in today about COVID. So here's one email. Can you talk about low back pain associated with long haul COVID? I had some typical back pain after contracting COVID in mid-May. The pain in my low back has grown exponentially worse despite physical therapy, acupuncture, massage, and chiropractic adjustments. Several articles I've seen are associated low back pain with Omicron in particular. Dr. Pate, what do you know about this?
Yeah, so, you know, the thing about long COVID or these kind of chronic sequela that occur following COVID, they are manifest very differently and very broadly. So people have everything from, you know, just the disturbed taste and smell persisting to they have, you know, heart problems to neurologic problems, the brain fog, all kinds of different things. And back pain is less common, but pain syndromes and muscular problems and even the potential for autoimmune and other kinds of problems are certainly things that we are starting to see more of and investigate further to understand why they occur. I think we are making some progress in understanding why some of these things happen. It is complicated, but we certainly are seeing it. And people, one of the things that can happen with long COVID that we've noticed in a fair number of people is that the COVID infection reactivates underlying Epstein-Barr virus. And when that gets activated, people could have a kind of a chronic fatigue kind of syndrome that can include a lot of muscular aches and pains. So I think the important thing is, since it's not getting better with very common sense approaches, massage, exercise, et cetera, I think really need to see a physician because there's all kinds of things that we have to consider.
So Dr. Pate, I want to move to monkeypox because we have gotten quite a few questions this last week. So the first one is about the limited supply of the monkeypox vaccine around the country, but in particular in Idaho. So how do you get on the list for the vaccine in Idaho?
Yes. So there is a limited amount of the vaccine, and it has, since last month, the end of last month, started getting distributed to the states in allocations. And then the states have to determine, you know, who gets that limited vaccine. Because it's limited, it's being only offered at present to the highest risk groups. Currently, and I do think this will change, but currently, the highest risk groups of people that are getting monkeypox are particularly men who are homosexual or bisexual, who are having sex with men, and particularly multiple partners. And so those are the people that they're going to meet the eligibility to get the vaccine in any state, anywhere. Some states may loosen up a little bit from that and include some other folks, some sex workers, other kinds of situations where you're going to be in contact with a lot of people. So you should check with your local public health official. I did talk to Central District Health yesterday, and you can contact them. I tweeted that out last night, and Jimmy, you may want to have that information out from the radio station as well. But there's a number you can call. And the good thing about it is we know that there are some people that are very, because they know there's a lot of stigma attached with this, they may be reluctant to go get vaccinated. But you can go to the Central District Health Clinic, and it's very discreet, handled very confidentially, and go ahead and get your vaccine. What has happened is, because there's a shortage of vaccine, the FDA did just recently tell us that we can change the amount of vaccine and the way that we're giving it. So now we're giving 1/5 of the dose, and instead of giving it as a kind of a deeper shot into the arm, you can give it what's called intradermally, which means that it kind of like, if any of you have had a TB test, how they just put it right under the top of your skin and then they kind of blow up a little bubble under there with the vaccine. That's how we can do it now. And it seems to be giving just as good of immune protection from all that we can tell so far. So with that, it may be that we'll actually be able to loosen the criteria and more people can get the vaccine, because certainly, as we've talked about before, it's not just men who are having sex with men who are getting monkeypox. We do see this in women, we unfortunately do see this in children. So we're going to hopefully be able to expand those categories. But for right now, that's the target group.
So, Dr. Pate, what about your concerns in regards to monkeypox and children? We do know that at least 8 children have gotten it in the United States. And I think we're learning more about if you're pregnant and you get exposed to this.
That's true, Gemma. So, you know, the concerns are, you know, obviously monkeypox is acting differently right now. We've known about monkeypox for decades because we've seen outbreaks in Africa. And the way it's acting now is different than that. So we don't know if that's because of mutations or just because of the right opportunities. We're not quite sure why that's happening. However, what was clear even from our experience in Africa is that women who were pregnant that got infected could transmit the virus to the fetus, often with very tragic consequences. And we saw that children, so it's kind of the opposite of COVID, children actually do worse with monkeypox than do adults. And that could be because some adults still have some protection from their smallpox vaccines. There's a lot of different theories about why that is, but children, and now the CDC has acknowledged that it does look like that children, particularly under the age of 8, may be at risk for worse outcomes. And the vaccine is not currently approved for children or authorized for children. Now, in the event of a serious exposure, they are making some exceptions. But we do worry about the kids, and we do worry about pregnant moms, particularly as those two being the two highest risk groups if they actually contract the disease. They're not the highest risk for catching the disease, but they are highest risk of bad outcomes if they contract the disease.
Okay, that's good to know. Are you worried about asymptomatic spread of monkeypox at all?
Yes, you know, Gemma, that's a great point. You know, like I said, this virus is acting differently. What we had seen previously in Africa is that generally most of the spread of monkeypox was in households and was with people that were having very close contact to somebody who already had the rash, had the skin lesions, and particularly some of these skin lesions that had opened, and so that they could be exposed to those liquid. So in the past, we hadn't seen a lot of asymptomatic spread. Of course, also in Africa, there wasn't a lot of testing for it. So if you don't test, you're not going to know. But nevertheless, we hadn't seen that. What has been concerning is that we now have seen some evidence that there are, because we've had in France, one of the clinics that treats sexually transmitted diseases actually screened some of their patients who were being seen for other reasons, went ahead and just did the PCR test for monkeypox. And even though these men did not have symptoms, there were about 6% of them were turning up with positive PCR tests. And so theoretically, now we don't know for sure, but theoretically, it at least raises the potential that, okay, maybe they could spread this virus because we're getting evidence of they have the virus. Maybe they can spread it even though they don't have symptoms. So again, not confirmed yet, but this is a mounting concern because that's what we saw with COVID. It was very hard to control this disease when people didn't have symptoms because they didn't know they were at risk. And, mm-hmm. and so any disease that can cause asymptomatic disease that of something that's very contagious is going to be a big concern.
Dr. Payne, I only have about 2 minutes left, but I do want to touch on this really quickly. And this is polio. And I know we can talk more about this next week as well. But polio was eradicated in the United States in 1979. I am not vaccinated for polio because it was eradicated. Why have we now seen polio again?
Yeah, this is terribly disappointing. And it's because we did not get vaccines to all of the world. So there are two countries, Afghanistan and Pakistan, that did not get and have not promoted widespread vaccination like the rest of the world has. Therefore, what is happening is when vaccine is used, first of all, they can get wild type virus. But other thing is that as we're continuing to use vaccine in some countries, we don't in the United States, but in other countries where it does have live virus, the children get protected from polio, but they excrete the virus, and then somebody who's unvaccinated can get infected. That is what happened in New York. Someone that was probably an international traveler who had received the oral vaccine with the live virus, because we don't do that in the United States, brought it here, shed the live virus, and it infected a man with tragic results. He is now paralyzed, and that's not reversible. He's paralyzed from polio because he was not vaccinated as a child. Mm. Key thing is all the parents, the vaccine that we use in the United States is inactivated polio virus. In other words, you cannot give your child polio from it, and your child will not make anybody else sick from polio. And it's called IPV. Check to make sure that at least by the time your child is 2 years old, they have received 4 doses of IPV. If they have not, get in touch with your doctor and get your child caught up. It's not too late.
Okay. We will talk more about this next week, as well as monkeypox. And we even got a question about the flu, Dr. Pate. So we have a lot to talk about next week as well. So if you have questions, send them to us, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. As always, Dr. Pate, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.